Good Morning Pensacola. Andrew McKay and the Pensacola Morning News starts right now.
Morning, 5:09 here on News Radio Pensacola. I'm Andrew McKay. It's Pensacola Morning News, and good weekend. If you're worried about the lights at the BJ's, I don't think the aliens are planning an invasion, but you never know. You never know. We have to drive right past her to come to work, and this morning they were flashing. Jimmy, can you confirm for me that it was weird?
It's very odd.
Like all the LED up high, you know, 50-foot up or 40-foot up lights were flashing in sync around the BJ's only, which is like, well, this is not quite as cool as Three Mile Bridge, but it is flashing, and it's interesting. So, you know, just weird stuff afoot in the world. To misquote Keanu Reeves, strange things afoot at the BJ's. 437-1620 is my phone number. The shooting in Okaloosa County involving the airman and the deputy who has now been fired. This story, case, problem, whatever you want to consider, it becomes, I read the whole report yesterday. It's 29 pages. Okaloosa Sheriff's Office puts out this report detailing their internal evaluation, their procedural assessment, okay? So this is not the FDLE report. This is not a report dealing with matters of crime or not crime, okay? We don't have that yet. This is the Administrative Internal Affairs Investigation. And the purpose of the AI is to figure out if he violated OCSO policy. And if he did, the deputy, Duran, Deputy Duran, if he violated the policy, then, you know, they either decide to discipline him or to fire him for his role in the death of Roger Fortson, Airman Roger Fortson. Okay? So read the whole report, and they have fired him in case you didn't catch the news or weren't aware. And the reason they fired him is actually fairly straightforward, because they have a couple of principles or general orders for their use of force. One, it says deadly force shall only be used when the officer reasonably believes that the action is in defense of human life, including the officer's own life, or in defense of any person in imminent danger of serious physical injury. A very standard use, a very standard expression of the use of deadly force policy. That applies to you just in general life. Okay, you are only allowed to draw a gun, shoot a gun, stab with a knife, hit with a baseball bat, you know, if you believe that that is in defense of human life, including your own, or in defense of another person in imminent danger of serious physical injury. We've talked about this dozens, perhaps hundreds of times with our law enforcement officers, because I want you to know what the law is if you come into the unfortunate circumstance where you're forced to decide whether to shoot or not shoot, or draw or not draw with somebody. Okay, so this is even though this is the expression of policy in the Okaloosa Sheriff's Office procedural manual, this applies to you too. Like, this is for everybody. The policy also explains deadly force, resistance. That's if this would be more for law enforcement. If somebody is resisting in a way that would justify deadly force, okay? Deadly force resistance is a subject's hostile attacking movements with or without a weapon that create a reasonable perception by the officer that the subject intends to cause and has the capability of causing death or great bodily harm to the officer or others. You follow? So this is a very clear expression of when you are or are not allowed to use, for example, your gun to shoot a suspect because they are using deadly force resistance. For example, okay, Ferguson, Michael Brown, reaches inside Darren Wilson's car, grabs for his gun. He's completely justified in shooting him at this point. The gun winds up being discharged, okay? And later, and then Michael Brown runs away, and Darren Wilson gets out and says, stop, 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 and Michael Brown turns around and runs at him. Another completely justified. It looks like the first one was inadvertent, but it would have been justified, and the second ones that killed him, clearly justified, okay? Just to kind of put a different case's perspective on this. Of course, in this situation, the basic problem is that after knocking, after announcing a couple of times, unclear about the situation, responding to a domestic disturbance call, Deputy Duran has the door opened Fortson opens the door and is standing there with his own personal handgun in his hand, pointed down at the ground. Fortson tells, or Duran tells him, you know, back up. And then he sees the gun. He says, drop the gun, but he shoots at the same time. Okay? As he's telling him to drop the gun, he shoots. Shoots five times, eventually dies. Right? You've seen the video, or at least you've heard us talk about this enough times, just kind of to know the facts. The key elements of this case in the administrative investigation are that when Mr. Fortson opens the door, this is reading from the report, the former deputy stated he saw Mr. Fortson holding a firearm in his right hand. The firearm was pointed at the ground sufficiently enough for the former deputy to clearly see the rear face of the rear sight. It's a Glock. In case you don't know, Glocks have this little, this white, very, very visible. It's designed to be visible to you at night. That's the purpose of it. If you're holding the gun, pointing it at somebody, even with very little light, you'll see the white U-shape. It's a block U-shape on the back of the gun. He, in all of this situation, the deputy sees the U. He even sees that it's got a red dot sight, so he sees that the gun is not pointed at him because you can't see the sights of the gun if the gun's pointed at you. Okay, it's pointed down. 7, the former deputy confirmed Mr. Fortson did not physically resist him in any way. And the investigation concluded that Mr. Fortson did not point the gun in the former deputy's direction, either of which would have justified drawing and shooting. Or at least potentially drawing and shooting, right? Because if he fears for his life, fears for the life of others. So he's not resisting. He's not pointing the gun at him. He did not follow procedure. So they fired him. And if you read the rest of the report, the real question that most people, I think, want to know is not did he follow procedure, although, of course, they want to know that. He clearly did not follow procedure. The question is, did he commit a crime? And that is a much more complicated question. Complicated because the standard is whether in the mind of a reasonable observer, the reasonable person standard that Sheriff Simmons and I are always talking about, would a reasonable observer or a reasonable person in the situation that the deputy was in at the time have believed that his life or the life of somebody else or great bodily injury was at risk, and therefore would they have been justified in using deadly force? Now, you can find that somebody violated policy. At least I believe this is the case. I'm like 90% sure of this. We'll verify when we talk to our law enforcement. But you can violate policy and not commit a crime, right? You can have done something that justifies terminating you, but it doesn't justify you going to jail, okay? So in order to understand the question of did he commit a crime, you have to get inside his head. You have to understand what he was thinking at the moment that he shot the airman. And let me be clear up front. This is, at the very least, a horrible tragedy. Clearly. The question is it a crime? And when I first read the headlines and read the story, and to be honest with you, when I first talked to some of my law enforcement friends after, like, my first initial was I want to know more, okay, because it looks bad, but I want to know more, and I wasn't sure because holding a gun. And basically what they all told me was if you're pointing a gun down, you're not a threat, therefore it's not a justified shooting. That's the kind of the – there might be circumstances that would change that default view, but that's the default view. And that's what the report says. He's not resisting. He's not constituting a threat. The gun's not pointed at the deputy, okay? Crime, though, is going to take a slightly different standard. And again, what you're basically going to have to figure out is whether the deputy believed himself to be in danger. And here it's worth reading through the report, which you don't have to, but I did. The investigation, the interview with the deputy after the event. Okay, so this is not at the time. This is after the event. By the way, the deputy after the event, Deputy Duran, he's swearing, he's saying the F word, he can't believe what happened, he's frustrated, he's slamming the wall, which I think is a very understandable reaction to what just happened. Also, I say this only so you understand some of the background of the story, and I know in saying it, it's going to sound like I'm defending him, but I'm not. I'm just trying to give you information. Prior to this incident, you would have described this guy as an American hero. There's no other way. He served in the U.S. Army from 03 to 14, combat deployment Iraq 08, started career in military intelligence in 07, went into military law enforcement. While an MP, he received additional training through the Army Special Reaction Team, honorable discharge. Started as a canine officer in Oklahoma, 15 through 19. From 16 to 17, he was a fire marshal for the Altus Fire Department, in addition to being a canine cop. In 19, before moving to Florida and beginning career at Okaloosa County Sheriff's Office, he accepted a position as a sergeant for the Civilian Law Enforcement Police Department on Altus Air Force Base. Began at Okaloosa County in 2019, left in 2021 to follow his spouse, who had a career opportunity outside of Florida. So came here, moved away. Spouse's career returned them to Florida when in 2023 he rejoined Okaloosa County Sheriff's Office. At first, he accepted a position with the Department of Child and Families, DCF. Schedule facilitated completion of his undergraduate degree. The undergraduate degree is a bachelor's in criminal psychology. He's about halfway through a human service counseling master's degree with a focus on crisis response and trauma. 2023 comes back. Schedule facilitated his completion of the undergrad degree. Left DCF in good standing and returned to Okaloosa County Sheriff's Office last year. And then we have this incident this year. So prior to this, what you would describe him as is, I mean, model citizen, ideal hero, okay? And that context for me when I read through the report was important because every stage of this incident prior to the shooting, and again, this is, you know, 3 weeks later with the interview from the Internal Affairs, but I'll just read to you some of this, okay? I asked Deputy Duran what he was thinking when he entered the elevator to go to apartment 1401. That was the correct apartment, by the way. He said, "I'm going into a call that had escalated from verbal to physical and that it had become increasingly violent and one of the parties had become increasingly violent over a period of time." Because people claim that they heard yelling, profanity, escalation is what it sounded like to them, okay? Whether this was a different apartment, whether this was the FaceTime call, we don't really know, but that's what the reports were. So it's mindset. What's he going into? I asked Deputy Duran why he chose not to wait for a second deputy. He said, "So when I was gathering the information and from what I was being told and what I knew at the specific time, it had begun as a verbal altercation, which then had escalated into a physical altercation. So my thought process was if I don't intervene, I didn't want the, you know, event to escalate into something that could be even, you know, more of a violent crime." I asked Deputy Duran if he'd received training that taught direct to threat principles. He said he had. I asked him to explain direct to threat as he understood it. He explained, "Direct to threat to me entails when we are aware of violent crime taking place, that it is our responsibility to go forward without, you know, hesitation and making, ensuring the threat is either eliminated or, you know, stopped." Think the Parkland. Go to the threat. I asked Deputy Duran if he understood why law enforcement teaches direct to threat instead of waiting for more law enforcement officers. He answered, "Hesitation can lead to more violent offenses, and the whole purpose is to stop the violent offenses." I'm not reading the "us." There's a lot of pauses in his answer. I asked Deputy Duran if he heard signs of a disturbance as he was walking down the breezeway. He said, "No, sir." So reports, but no evidence of a disturbance. Why he listened at the door after knocking, to hear anything, to see if he heard anything, to gain information, intelligence on what was going on. And, you know, it wasn't clear. Okay. As he's thinking through what he's doing in front of the door, it's all kinds of things. Like, on his right is a firm hallway. On his left is a balcony. To the end, there's no escape. So if something goes down, as in if somebody comes out against him or somebody starts shooting at him, what's his defense? What happens to him? Former Army guy, right? I mean, and also that's what they train cops to do, is think about, what's your defense if this happens? What if everything goes to hell? What do I do? And also, you know, do you put yourself at risk by standing in a certain place? And he goes through all of this, thinking about this again and again and again in his head. You know, where do I want to be? Where do I want to go? What happens if he comes after me? Okay. And then the door answers and Fortson is standing there with a gun, which he doesn't see immediately, but which his first command to Fortson when he opens the door is, "Step back." And what he says is he sees Duran step forward, a slight step forward with his left leg. And so he did not believe Fortson was complying with him. Now, it's very quick. It's the immediate thing. But his perception was that he was disobeying a command of step back from the door. I asked Deputy Duran when he saw Mr. Fortson's firearm. He answered, "It was step back gun." As soon as the door initially opens, I see him moving forward. I tell him step back. But as I'm telling him step back, I'm looking at his eyes. And then I immediately look at his hands, which is what I've been trained to do. Look at the eyes. Tells me a lot about a person's intent. Look at the hands. Obviously tells me if they're empty, open-handed, balled up, you know, have a gun, weapon, knife, whatever it is. So as I'm taking all of it in, I see him, and we're talking, you know, split second, right? It's less than a second. Or, well, less than 3 seconds, anyway. I see him step forward. I see his eyes. I look down. I see his hands. And, of course, that's when I see the gun. I asked Deputy Duran about his impression when he looked at Mr. Fortson. He said, when I saw his eyes, I saw aggression. I saw, you know, obviously, again, interacting with individuals in these types of situations. You're dealing with people who are most likely enduring the worst time of their life at that particular moment. So I see aggression, anger. I asked him to explain what made him believe he saw aggression. He explained when I looked at him and he made eye contact, or I made eye contact with him, it was a stare that was fixated 100% on me, which, as I'm looking at him, it wasn't eyebrows raised, hey, what's going on, inquisitive, why are you here? It was a stare. Not so much like I said, inquisitive look, so that showed me there was aggression. That showed me there was obviously a little bit of discontent for me knocking on the door, which I think is pretty normal when somebody knocks on your door and says, you know, come out. So then, as soon as he sees the gun, he says, drop the gun, and he draws, and he shoots. Based on everything that I had taken into account, I felt 100% that action was going to be my best course as opposed to reaction, like waiting for him to do something. Based on how close we were, the proximity, obviously there was maybe 3 to 4 feet of a reactionary gap, whereas a typical reactionary gap is going to be 6 to 8 feet. I immediately felt that I was at a disadvantage considering he had his gun readily available for use and mine was still holstered. So at that point, again, action was going to be better for than reaction to prevent any kind of great bodily harm or death to myself. And also he says that the gun was not straight down but sort of angled forward a little bit. In a, it doesn't represent a threat, but it represents it could be pulled up a little bit faster. Not in a shooting from the hip position, but definitely not pointed straight down deliberately away like you might sometimes do. Now, this is with his lawyer. This is 2.5 weeks later. There's certainly the possibility that he's seen the tape perhaps hundreds of times, talked with his lawyer about their likely defense. This is all possible. But you have to take for a starting point the possibility that he's just describing the event as he understood it. And as he understood it, if he didn't take action, he didn't go home that day. Here's why I say all of that. I still agree, absolutely agree with the firing of him. I agree that he violated policy. What I don't think is going to happen is I don't think that he's going to get sent to jail based on this defense. But that's why you have a trial. Do I think charges will be brought? You cannot predict whether a state attorney is going to bring charges. Based on the totality of the circumstances and the public significance, I'd be surprised there aren't charges brought. But I would also think that a jury is likely to acquit. But I don't know that's why you have a trial. 527 on News Radio Pensacola. I'm Andrew McKay.
This is a test of the emergency alert system. This is only a test.
I feel occasional burning and stabbing in my hands as I age.
I sometimes feel numbness and tingling in my feet as I get older.
It's starting to get in the way of doing what I love.
At Nervive, we hear you, and we can help. Nervive's clinically studied dose of alpha-lipoic acid reduces occasional nerve discomfort in as little as 7 days with continued daily use.
Now that I know, I'm taking control.
Try Nervive Nerve Relief and say yes to healthy nerves.
These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
This is the story of the one. As a maintenance engineer, he hears things differently. To the untrained ear, everything on his shop floor might sound fine, but he can hear gears grinding or a belt slipping. So he steps in to fix the problem at hand before it gets out of hand. And he knows Granger's got the right product he needs to get the job done, which is music to his ears. Call, click Granger.com, or just stop by. Granger, for the ones who get it done.
Join Keith and Pam, your insurance experts with Verus Health Partners, today at 9 on the Pensacola Expert Panel. Learn how to save money on your healthcare costs. Find the right insurance products that best fits the needs for you and your family as you head towards retirement or are looking for options now. They will be taking your calls and questions today at 9 with Verus Health Partners on the Pensacola Expert Panel.
The Pensacola Expert Panel, 9 to 11 weekdays on News Radio 92.3 AM 1620.
Local experts share their expertise on the Pensacola Expert Panel. It's Pep Talk on News Radio 92.3. Informative, local, dependable.
Look, mister, there's three rules you've got to follow.
Yeah, what kind of rules?
Keep him out of the light. He hates bright light, especially sunlight. It'll kill him.
And we go a little something like this. Hit it. Come on.
Good morning, 529 here on News Radio Pensacola. I'm Andrew McKay. It's Pensacola Morning News. Sunrise today. Looks like it's going to be a pretty good one with some interesting cloud formations behind the red sky. So if you get a chance, peek out. It's happening right now. David Wayne is in the newsroom. I told him to put his shades up earlier, and he didn't obey me. So,
well, I'm doing it right now. You're right. It's a beautiful sunrise.
It's outstanding.
It's very nice.
What's in the newsroom, sir?
Well, on to the next big trial this week. Jury selection beginning today in Delaware in the federal firearms case against Hunter Biden. He's accused of illegally buying and possessing a gun while being addicted to drugs back in 2018. So we'll see what happens with this one.
Yeah, and I know a lot of people are looking at this as if they convicted Trump, they have to convict Hunter. That is not how the legal system works, so I would not get your hopes up one way or the other about anything like that going on.
Fox News, I'm CJ Papa. The trial begins in federal court, Wilmington, Delaware, for Hunter Biden.
250 people will be narrowed down to 12 jurors who will determine whether Hunter Biden is guilty of three federal gun charges. Federal prosecutors say Hunter lied about his drug use on a form to buy a gun in October 2018, a gun that he kept for 11 days.
Fox's Manuel Rivera, he's the first child of a sitting president to be prosecuted. President Biden on the move.
President Biden will be in Greenwich, Connecticut this evening for an exclusive fundraiser with local politicians and business leaders. Access to the sold-out event reportedly costs $3,300 per person.
Fox's Jackie Ibanez. Mexico elects its first female president. Claudia Sheinbaum takes over October 1st, succeeding Andres Manuel Lopez Obrador. America's listening to Fox News.
Good morning, 531 at News Radio Pensacola. I'm David Wayne, 73 degrees and partly cloudy skies this morning in Pensacola. A Pensacola man charged with a DUI. This is after causing a wrong-way crash on I-110 on Friday. FHP arrested 28-year-old Liam Collins. They say he sideswiped a vehicle while driving north in the southbound lanes of I-110 Friday night. Troopers say Collins' vehicle had nearly struck the other vehicle head-on. Debris from that sideswipe then damaged another vehicle that was driving on the interstate. Both Collins and his passenger were taken to the hospital after the crash. The drivers of the other vehicles involved in this were not hurt. Collins was arrested after being medically cleared at the hospital. He was booked and has since been released on a $1,000 bond from the Escambia County Jail. Well, there is a new offer on the table for the OLF 8 property in Beulah. Tri-W Development out of Montgomery, Alabama, has now reportedly offered Escambia County $36 million. Now, that would be for the entire property. That offer was announced on Commissioner Jeff Burgosh's online blog last Friday. He says commissioners will have to see how this proposal follows the master plan. The proposal does include a land donation to the Escambia School District for a school to be built on the property. Commissioners are also still considering a $25 million offer for a portion of that land from Beulah Town Center, LLC. Now, both of those offers are expected to be discussed at Thursday's Board of County Commissioners meeting. A Pensacola man arrested over the weekend after allegedly attacking a group of people using a glass bottle and a gun. That happened on Saturday night. Police say 25-year-old Ramadani Richardson was involved in a dispute with the group in the roadway at Palafox Place and Intendencia Streets. Officers say he first struck a person in the head with the glass bottle, then fired gunshots into the group. One person was shot in the leg. Others were injured by shrapnel, but everybody is expected to be all right. Richardson now faces multiple charges, including 5 counts of aggravated battery, possession of a firearm by a felon, firing a weapon in the city, and an out-of-state warrant as well. He's being held with no bond at the Escambia County Jail. 534 News Radio Pensacola. Let's get a look at our Channel 3 weather forecast this morning.
This is meteorologist Brooke Richardson with your first morning weather update. We will have a chance of rain as we go through the afternoon today. 40% chance of showers and thunderstorms. A few storms could be strong. Temperatures today very warm with highs in the upper 80s and low 90s. We will feel more like the mid-90s to 100 degrees. Overnight tonight, temperatures dropping near 74. For Tuesday, mostly sunny skies, high near 92. Tuesday night, temperatures dropping near 71. Stay connected to Channel 3 News' first morning weather team. Download the WEAR-TV weather app. This is Brooke Richardson from the First Morning Weather Center.
And right now, it's 73 in Pensacola, 74 in Gulf Breeze, and it's 72 in Milton. Your next news at 6 and breaking news anytime it happens. I'm David Wayne for News Radio Pensacola.
Out of 2,000 trucks and Lexus vehicles, because the engines in some 2022 to 2023 Tundra and LX vehicles may have machine debris that was not cleared during production. The carmaker said debris may cause the engine to knock, run rough, fail to start, or lose power. The company said that it is currently developing the remedy for the issue and plans to alert owners of the affected vehicles by late July. Futures are mixed. That's your money now.
Eric was way behind on his taxes.
I owed a lot of money to the IRS, almost $15,000. I tried to make payments.
The IRS wasn't satisfied with Eric's efforts, so they came after him full force.
They're coming to put a lien and a hold on all my income, my home, my car. I was just overwhelmed at what to do.
Then Eric called Optima Tax Relief.
When Optima Tax got involved, the calls would stop, the threats would stop. It was easy, like, 1, 2, 3.
Optima Tax Relief is A-plus rated by the Better Business Bureau and their team of expert tax professionals.
Hey, Dave Ramsey here. You've heard me talk about one car dealership in Pensacola, Frontier Motors at 230 Beverly Parkway. Folks, new cars lose 11% of their value the second you drive them off the lot. So for years, Frontier Motors has been saving Pensacola residents thousands of dollars by getting them into the best previously owned vehicles. And thousands of people have enjoyed Frontier Motors' no hassle, no pressure experience. Just the best slightly used vehicles in town at a fair price. But don't take my word for it. Look around and you'll start noticing all the Frontier Motors decals and tags. They're everywhere. So if you're in the market for a vehicle, do yourself a favor and see the friendly folks and the huge inventory at Frontier Motors. You can't miss them. Just look for the big buffalo on the lot. That's Frontier Motors at 230 Beverly Parkway. And don't forget to tell them Dave Ramsey said hey.
As a small business owner, what keeps you up at night? Just knowing if your email got hacked or your phone system went down, it could cost you thousands in revenue as well as your reputation. That's where Data Revolution comes in with their unique position to take care of you and your business IT support, phone systems, cybersecurity, and more. Secure it and sleep better at night by going to datarevs.com. Winner of the 2021 Best of the Bay for IT support, datarevs.com.
Tune in to the Pensacola Expert Panel Wednesday at 10:30 when guests from Florida Power & Light will be on the show discussing programs and resources available to its customers. From recent rate reductions and storm preparedness efforts to tips on how to save energy and other community initiatives, the experts will discuss FPNL's commitment to their customers and our community.
The Pensacola Expert Panel on News Radio 92.3 and AM 1620. Text or call with your questions. 850-437-1620.
News Radio Pensacola has you covered no matter where you are or how you like to listen. Tune into our frequencies on 92.3 FM, 95.3 FM, and AM 1620 for the latest breaking news, local updates, and in-depth analysis. Can't be near a radio? No problem. Stream us live on our website or through our convenient app. Available for download on your mobile device. Plus, with our smart device integration, you can ask your virtual assistant to play News Radio 92.3 and we'll be right there with you. It's News Radio Pensacola.
What do you need, son?
Need to borrow your boat.
Let's drop some lead on those motherfuckers.
Light them up.
They ain't gonna sink this battleship, no way.
Verify our range to target. One ping only.
What's the range now?
200 miles, sir.
They break 150 miles, launch the alert 5 aircraft.
Yes, sir.
What are you doing? You're slowing down! You're slowing down!
I'm bringing him in closer, Merlin.
You're gonna do what?
I got a good lock. Firing.
Yes, on Fridays at 7:35, we are doing a series that we'll be doing for quite some time, I would imagine. It's called Meet Your Tenant Commands, and the idea is that I want all of us to have a better understanding of what takes place on board NAS Pensacola, NAS Whiting Field, and Corry Station. And that means talking to the commanding officers of the various tenant commands that occupy operations on those properties. So it's just a long-term. I've been wanting to do this for forever, and we are just starting now. We've done our third one. On Friday, we had a chance to talk extensively with Marine Colonel Anthony Fez Crockle, the Commodore of Training Wing 5 at NAS Whiting Field. Colonel, welcome to the Pensacola Morning News, sir.
Thanks, Andrew. Appreciate you having me on the show.
Absolutely. These are questions that just people have who don't know, and those are the folks we're trying to explain things to. What is a Commodore?
So the Commodore is a honorary title. It's a Navy title for commanding officers at a major command level, 06 level, that are in command of operational units.
So, and this is one of the things that sometimes civilians have trouble with is things like, okay, so he's a colonel, but he's a Commodore, and he's a commanding officer. Which one? Well, all.
know, right.
All of them.
In my case, all three.
That's exactly right. This is kind of unusual, though, and we probably ought to talk about this at the beginning, is this is one of the most important commands in the aviation training pipeline because you oversee both the primary instruction for fixed-wing aircraft but also the advanced instruction for rotary-wing aircraft, helicopters, and what you might call ordinary planes. But you're not a member of the Navy, and so why is that? That's kind of unusual.
Sure. So we train all Navy, Marine Corps, Coast Guard helicopter pilots, as well as 12 partner countries trust us with training their students to become naval aviators in their respective countries. So it's a fantastic organization. I mean, we have three primary squadrons, that's VT-2, VT-3, and VT-6, teaching T-6 training, so primary or basic flight training. And then at Southfield, we have three more squadrons teaching helicopter training. That's HD 8, 18, and 28.
So you have, and for me anyway, it's really helpful to think about it as almost two separate air operations, two separate airports, even though they're on the same campus. The north or the northwest or whatever is where you're in the Texan, the T-6 Texan. That's the turbo prop that people see flying overhead, the orange and the white coloring, and then the other one is either a combination of the Sea Ranger, which is the old helicopter, or the new T-73 Thrasher, which is more orange in color, but that's a brand new one, and that's the South operation. So when people come out of training from Redman, okay, they come out of the sort of knife, the Naval Introductory Flight Evaluation, and then they go to you at the North Field to get primary flight instruction, right?
Right.
And what does that entail? What's that process involve?
Sure, yeah. So the whole process is about 7 months long, and they'll start out in ground school learning T-6 systems, fuel, electrical, hydraulic, that sort of thing. Then they'll go into simulators. Then they'll start flying in what we call the contact phase, and that phase consists of, learning how to handle the aircraft with stalls and spins, and then learning how to do course rules, basically the way we fly in and out of the airport, and also how to do a basic landing pattern, right? Touch and goes and that sort of thing. After that, they'll split off in either one of two branches based off of operational requirements. They'll either go to a formation stage where they'll learn how to fly very close to another aircraft. Not as close as the Blues, but certainly in what we call parade formation. And then they'll split off and go to learn how to fly instruments. In other words, learn how to fly when you can't see a visible horizon outside, in the clouds, in other words. And then they'll typically culminate with a couple of day and night visual navigation flights based off of terrain features on the ground. And then they'll finish up and select into a different pipeline. So they'll either go jets or they'll go maritime, V-22s, or helicopters.
So this process, and they go, they do either instruments or formation, and then whichever one they did first, they have to then do the other one. They're both required. It's just a question of what makes more sense in a production sense, you know, which to come first, right?
Right.
So they graduate through that, and then, as you say, they're gonna select for the jets or fixed wing or the Osprey or whatever, and that's basically by how well they did. Typically, jets are the better performers and so forth. Is that the idea usually?
So typically, our number one student can select whatever they want, but everyone else after that is largely a function of their desire, but also the needs of the Navy, right? There could be a case where there are, you know, zero V-22 spots open that week, and they won't be able to select for it. So it's needs of the Navy, Marine Corps, and Coast Guard, but also the desires of the student and, of course, the performance of the student. There is a minimum requirement to become a jet pilot in terms of their grades.
And what is it, about two-thirds of all of the primary flight instruction is going to come to Whiting, and the other third goes to Corpus Christi after they go through NIFE, is that right?
Correct. So there's five squadrons total for primary. Three of them are here, and two of them are Corpus.
Okay, perfect. Very good. And how many students is that at a time?
So I will tell you, I have 1,100 students here that I graduate between fixed-wing training, primary, and advanced helicopter training. That's a staggering 91,000 flight hours. I wouldn't be able to do it without the help of 380 instructor pilots. And, of course, we have 330 aircraft here on station. So that's why you see us flying around all those orange and white helicopters and planes all the time.
Busiest flight operations in the world, if I'm not mistaken. Is that right?
Yeah. So if you include all of our outlying fields, it is the biggest or the busiest, compound in terms of air operations.
Very good. We're talking to Colonel Anthony Fez Crockle, the Commodore of Training Air Wing 5 at Nanny S. Whiting Field. Okay, so Colonel, they get their way through primary flight instruction, and then they graduate and they select. If they go big wing, they go to Corpus Christi. If they go helos, they stay there for advanced rotary training. And if they go jets, they go to what, Kingsville and Meridian, I believe. But if they stay here and they do helicopters, how does it change? Because the perception I've always had is that in basic flight instruction, primary flight instruction, you kind of want to, if they're not going to work out, you want to make sure they don't work out fast, so that you don't waste time and money and they don't waste time and career on something that's not going to work out. But in helicopters, it's a little bit different. Is that right?
Yeah, so we have an attrition rate here of about 9% for primary. Now, that includes all things. So it could be performance. It could be aeromedical adaptability, maybe somebody who just gets really sick in the plane. Or it could be medical reasons, right? So about 9% attrition in primary. So you're right. We do end up, we do want to figure out whether they are going to be ready to fly as a career early on. Now, as you can imagine, that gets cut in about half once you go to advanced because they're already done with primary. So at advanced, it's a little bit, the training is a little bit longer. It's about 8 months. But effectively, it's a similar process in terms of ground school, SIMS, contacts, formations, instruments. You're just living a completely different way to fly since now you're hovering, right?
Right. And very, 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 very intense in terms of academics, in terms of performance. You don't get to fail much, and you've got to know your stuff, and you've got to be able to do it and do it right and impress the instructors. Basically true across the board, right?
Absolutely. We do have a very high standard. I mean, we expect students to come prepared. And, you know, we find as the students who work as a team early and study in groups do better than others.
And when it comes to, now you talked earlier that in the T-6 and the Texan, the propeller plane, that the simulators are a part of that. But with the, especially with the new T-73 Thrashers, the new helicopters from Leonardo, these simulators are unbelievable. I've actually had a chance to fly one of those when we came up there for Leadership Santa Rosa. The simulator work is phenomenal, right?
The fidelity of the simulators is staggering. With state-of-the-art capabilities, some of the best helicopter sims you'll see in all of, even civilian in industry. We have mixed reality here. We have simulators that can model, you know, snow, sleet, rain. We can put a Navy ship in the ocean so that you can practice how to land on the ship in the ocean. The capabilities are absolutely amazing. And unlike the aircraft, right, they're unaffected by real weather and unaffected by, you know, the mechanical issues that we see at times.
So if I'm on the ground, I think this will help people to maybe relate to what you do a lot. If I'm on the ground, like yesterday, we were canoeing in Coldwater Creek. If I look up and I see one of the T-6 Texans flying overhead, who's in that plane?
So what you'll see around here is you'll see a student in the front seat and an instructor in the rear seat from one of the VT squadrons.
But at some point, the student is going to fly by themselves, right?
Correct. So they'll append their call sign solo at the end of their call sign. So the VT2 they're the duo birds. So they go by, and their call sign is Blackbird. VT3 are the Red Knights. So they go by Red Knight. And then VT6 they're the shooters. So they'll go shooter. So it might be a call sign would be shooter 1-2-3, and then when they're flying by themselves, it would be shooter 1-2-3 solo.
Okay. All right. And same for the helicopters. Mostly it's an instructor and a student, but then at some point they solo?
Correct. However, they do what's called a buddy solo. So they'll actually go out, because once we're flying helicopters, we know we're going to be flying a crewed aircraft for the rest of their career. So that becomes a focus of the training, from going from a single seat mindset and primary to a crewed aircraft in advance. So when they go solo, they'll actually find a buddy who may have just finished up advanced helicopter training and go on a solo with them.
Very interesting. And so,
no instructor.
Oh, okay. Oh, I see. Okay, so it's not quite a solo, but it's a more of a realistic simulation in the sense that they're going to fly that way in the fleet. They're not going to fly it by themselves in a helicopter. Okay. And I know you said it, but I just want to make sure people hear this part because it's so important. Every single person who is going to fly a helicopter in the Coast Guard, the Marines, and the Navy is going to come through Whiting in the advanced rotary training on the South Field. And 2/3 of all of the pilots of any kind are going to come through the north side of the field. And then some of them will go to rotor, some of them will go to jet, some of them will go to the big wing. One or two other quick questions. I knew we'd run out of time before I ran out of questions. Sometimes you take longer flights. A lot of the flights are between Whiting Field and these outlying fields around the area, which is how you practice. But then toward the end, you take a cross-country flight in both platforms, right?
Absolutely. You know, Pensacola is called the cradle of naval aviation.
Mm-hmm.
And this is where we all, this is where we learn how to fly. Now, it is a very scripted situation and scenario flying in and out of these local airports, right? You really get to learn when you get on the road and you get away from the cradle, right? So sort of get pushed out of the nest and go on the road and fly into really, you know, busy airspaces, you know, Washington, D.C. In fact, I'm going to be flying to Washington, D.C., starting to fly there to Washington, D.C. in about an hour. And we do a lot of flying on our weekends, both helicopters and on the fixed-wing side as well.
Very cool. I absolutely knew we would run out of time before we were able to get to, I mean, I got to about a third of my questions. But just this one thing I want to, what's an on-wing? If you can do it in a minute, what's an on-wing?
Sure. Your on-wing is the instructor pilot you are assigned to as soon as you start the flight training portion. And that on-wing is going to shepherd you and mentor you through your first, maybe 10 or so flights. And then after that, you're going to go and start learning from other instructors to get a sort of a different perspective on techniques.
So you start with one sort of, I hate to use this expression, but like your kindergarten instructor, and then they get you the place where you can start learning from a variety of grade school instructors, and then you get all of the things from there. Man, Colonel Crockle, great to talk to you. Thank you so much for the time this morning. We barely scratched the surface on what I know we could do for hours and talk about the training since it's a many, many weeks and many thousands of students process. But thank you so much for joining us this morning. Thanks for helping our folks understand what happens at NES Whiting Field and what they're seeing in the air when they see those planes and helicopters flying overhead.
Thanks for having me on the show, Andrew.
Absolutely. 5:54 here on News Radio Pensacola. And like I said, we're doing this, we're probably going to be doing this for at least a year just because the number of tenant commands. I mean, it might be 2 years. I don't know. We have a lot of information to get to. And I just, my goal is that at the end of this, or even now already, you have a better idea of what takes place at both Whiting and NES Pensacola, and eventually Corey as well. And we'll get all of these different people and all the different things that they do on, so you can really understand the military mission here in Northwest Florida. If you're thinking about that next vehicle, Frontier Motors is a great place to go looking for it. And I know you hear me talk about it, you hear Dave Ramsey talk about it. The question is, how many other people go there and are satisfied? Well, probably you know somebody who bought a car there. Ask them. Let me ask them. Or, if you don't, or even if you do, just look around. Like when you're driving around town, just keep an eye out, maybe when you're at the stoplight, okay? Just quickly survey the bumpers of the cars around you and see if you see a Frontier Motors license plate frame or a decal on the bumper. Because what'll happen is probably at first, if you do it like the first day, you'll be like, well, this is pointless. Where are they? And maybe you see one or two. And then a day later, you see maybe three or four. And then if you do this for a week, what you'll find is like, oh my God, they're everywhere. Did anybody buy cars anywhere else? And that's the point. Those are all satisfied customers. Your, friends and people who work near you and live near you and just drive around by you. And it's a chance for you to see just how many people Frontier Motors has sold cars to that they're happy about, that they keep that stuff on their car, right? Frontier Motors have been serving the Pensacola community for more than 25 years. Behind the Big Buffalo on Beverly Parkway. Be sure to tell them Andrew McKay says hi.
Remember when washing machines were made in America, were solidly built, and actually got your clothes clean? They aren't a thing of the past. They are Speed Queen, and they are available at Tops Appliance. Speed Queen washer and dryers combine durability and technology into the best washers and dryers in the world. Speed Queen will change the way you think about washing machines. They're built to last longer and deliver exceptional wash results. Unlike many other washers and dryers with plastic parts, Speed Queen uses commercial-grade steel and porcelain components designed to give you at least 25 years of reliable, trouble-free operation. That's why they come with lifetime warranties, the best warranties in the business. See store for warranty details. Speed Queen washers and dryers are built to work and built to last. If you want durability, innovation, and perfectly done laundry the first time, then you want Speed Queen. See these great Speed Queen washers and dryers for yourself at Tops Appliance on Highway 90 in Milton, just east of Stewart Street.
Join the Great Southern Restaurant Group, home to the Fish House, Atlas Oyster House, Jackson's, Angelina's, and Five Sisters Wednesday on the Pensacola Expert Panel at 9. They'll be talking about Father's Day, Beer Fest, dinner with strings attached, and other fun things you won't want to miss. That's all on the Pensacola Expert Panel with Great Southern Restaurants.
The Pensacola Expert Panel on News Radio 92.3 and AM 1620. Text or call with your questions. 850-437-1620.
The Port of Pensacola is more than just a name. It's a powerhouse of economic opportunities, a strategic location that sparks growth and prosperity, contributing significantly to the local and regional economy with 23 incredible businesses that call this port home. Big names like C-Max Materials, GE Wind Energy, and soon, the prestigious American Magic Sailing Team. Since 1754, the Port of Pensacola has been the driving force behind Northwest Florida's economic success. Explore more at portofpensacola.com.
Summer season is here and Florida's summers can really be hot. But despite the warm temperatures, your garden can still produce some beautiful flowers and delicious vegetables. Get all of your garden tips from me, Mike Wiggins, on The Garden Line, heard on the Pensacola Expert Panel every Tuesday from 9 till 10, and Encore Hour Saturday from 9 till 10, 92.3 AM 1620.
The Garden Line is presented by Barnes Feed Store, Pensacola Hardware, and Blue Sky Landscaping.
Get news at the top and bottom of every hour with WEAR-TV, our local news team, and Fox News on News Radio Pensacola.
Can I ask you another question?
Sure.
You probably get this a lot. This isn't the real Caesar's Palace, is it?
Wait, you're telling me this is not where Caesar slept? 5:59, David Wayne's in the newsroom with our headlines. David?
It'd be an easy mistake.
Yeah,
to
it's a common mistake. Yeah,
absolutely.
Sure.
The New York Times has apparently filed a lawsuit against the creator of an online game called World Dull. The New York Times says Corey McDonald's game is similar in appearance to its game, Wordle.
World Dull?
Wordle versus Wordle.
McDowell's Arts.
Listen on air at 92.3, 95.3, and AM 1620. News Radio 92.3. WNRP, Gulf Breeze, Milton, Pensacola.